Dostoevsky, Heidegger, and Korjev projecting the end of history. Heidegger's exercise, though not his quote-unquote politics, would have already been able to achieve its goal by mobilizing the collective of those who are not gripped. He wanted to do more than merely appeal to us to take up boredom, and indeed for a number of reasons. For one thing, he was not entirely sure of his own evocation of the true mood collective, because he had been influenced by the 19th century's heroic conceptions of history, and thus still expected the actions of great men and of states from real history, even if they began by negating their own possibility. For another, he intuitively understood that mobilizing the psycho-political collective of the authentically bored, those who feel empty and not gripped, does not at all result in a transition to a historically concrete collective, regardless of whether it were to take the form of a party, a nation, or of the quote-unquote West. Finally, it would have been clear to him that even his audience would expect more of him than being drafted into a disoriented mood collective. We will have to see how a German elite We will have to see how a supposed German elite of the profoundly bored in 1930 could turn into the national revolutionaries of 1933, whose slogans the philosopher began to project his ideas onto soon after the conclusion of this lecture course, only to become disgusted by them a short while later when he learned more about his odd allies. Before we do this, however, we will have to explain how the fundamental mood of boredom could have become a general European and German state of affairs. I would like to take up the above-mentioned thesis, according to which Heidegger may be considered the actual founder of the post-histoire theorem. In view of Heidegger's reputation as the ontologist of historicity, this claim is outlandish enough to require some explanation. Such an explanation will have to show what premises are necessary for us to be able to think of history as something that can come to an end at all, and how the difference here between end and goal comes into play. The concept of a time, quote-unquote, after history, is initially associated with the theological idea that God will one day reclaim the world he created and eo ipso cast into time, and indeed at that moment, that is humanly inconceivable, namely when he has finished with the world. If one translates these ideas into the language of secular logic, we find the assumption that history as a whole is pursuing an end, or an estuary, to put it more cautiously, in which the historical process is finished with itself. It could reach such a point if the energies that had impelled it forward until now were used up, or if the conflicts that had hitherto rendered it dynamic were completely resolved. Such an end would be humanly conceivable and ascertainable, in distinction to the transcendent conclusion brought about by God. As is well known, these kinds of ideas had previously been part of the Hegelian tradition, which had suggested the establishment of the constitutional state in the Napoleonic era, the cessation of class conflict following the Russian Revolution, and the satisfaction of the human striving for recognition, or rather, its hedonistic miniaturization, as possible criteria for admission into post-history. With that said, the claim that there is also a non-Hegelian route to the post-histoire thesis should now be plausible, although this was hardly mentioned in the corresponding discussions. According to our interpretation, Heidegger, with his powerful intuitions about the diagnosis of time, followed this alternative path to establishing the end of history, before he was compelled by his neo-heroic imperative to take a detour in order to devote himself to the creation, or letting happen, of supposedly decisive world historical actions, works, or events. The real father of the non-Hegelian theory of the end of history, it would be better to call it a vision or a daydream, which Heidegger occasionally espoused, is acknowledged to be Fyodor Dostoevsky, particularly in his short novel Notes from Underground, published in 1864. This work has to be recognized as the founding charter of modern ressentiment psychology, as well as founding charter of the anti-globalization sentiment, if such an anachronistic backdating of the term is allowed. The narrator of the virtuous monologue on the first part of the book, a bitter and comic prelude to philosophical anthropology offered in the first person, is a figure whom we would today call a modernization loser. He represents a neurotic version of Nietzsche's Last Man, a character whose motivation has been undermined, who can only satisfy his desire for self-respect by deviously taking pleasure in his own humiliation. He is someone who contrives his own misfortune and flirts with it. He settles into a cold, loathsome half-despair, into a half-belief, into a, quote, assiduously produced and yet somehow dubious hopelessness, end quote, which serves as an Archimedean point that he can use to unhinge the world of progressive minds. The narrator, in his squalid hole, which is described as a deliberately chosen dingy subterranean dwelling on the fringes of St. Petersburg, presents himself as a vehement critic of the Western way of life, an opponent of globalization in the parlance of our times. He also professes himself to be a man of the present day, and argues that the quote-unquote man of the 19th century is morally obligated to be a characterless creature. Almost the only claim in the subsequent cascade of words that he really seems to believe in. It gives him the greatest satisfaction to act like an anthropologist who marshals evidence that the predominantly pro-Western ideologists of the market, of relaxation, and of universalized humanitarianism have made their calculations without reference to actual human beings, or, to put it more precisely, without reference to the ungrateful and rebellious freedom of human beings, which amounts to little more than continually taking it into one's head to oppose every given order, even one promising universal happiness. In this context, the well-known neo-cynical thesis is formulated, according to which the human being is an ungrateful bipedal animal. Nietzsche could rightly remark that Dostoevsky's quote-unquote terrible and cruel work presents us with the sharpest mockery of the Delphic inscription, Know Thyself. The author of this confession clearly and intuitively understands himself to be a creature of boredom, a witness to an existence without beliefs, responsibilities, and obligations. His stream of words reflects whatever enters its author's mind, without reaching a standpoint of a truth worthy of being repeated. The rambling talk of the voice from underground thus demonstrates just how impossible it has become to participate in a meaningful history. Quote, I swear to you, gentlemen, that I do not believe a word, not one little word of all I've just scribbled. That is, I do believe, perhaps. But at the same time, who knows why, I sense and suspect that I'm lying like a cobbler. Well then, why did you write it all, you say to me? And what if I put you away for some 40 years with nothing to do, and then come to you in the underground after 40 years to see how you've turned out? One cannot leave a man alone and unoccupied for 40 years, can one? End quote. It is crucial to note that this man without commitments continually refers to those opposed to his own modus vivendi with the clairvoyance of the evil eye. He finds such opposition in the secular anthropology of progressive Western parties. Such progressives, whether liberal or socialist, believe that human beings have needs that can, in principle, be satisfied. They derived various policies for satisfying needs from this view, but the strategic differences of their policies could not conceal the fact that they were basically after the same thing. The Crystal Palace of London, erected in 1851, the greatest structure in architectural history at that time, was a public symbol of this belief. It was triumphantly erected in a mere 10 months to accommodate the first World's Fair in Hyde Park. It was set up again on an even larger scale in 1854 on Sydenham Hill near London as a popular indoor theme park. The Crystal Palace's articulation of the 19th century's civilising tendencies had a significance that can only be compared with the World Trade Centre in New York, whose collapse in September 2001 was symbolically on a par with it. The megastructure of Sydenham gave the citizens of that time a world satisfaction centre, in which the ultimate aims of the progressive way of life were completely revealed for all to see. The underground man is quite obviously a contemporary of the Crystal Palace, since he understands why the superb construct was erected. The Temple of Satisfaction is a house of worship for the anti-metaphysical project of modernity, which aims to dissuade satisfied human beings who have been accounted for, made equal and discreetly animalized, from the further use of their freedom. Historic tensions, Spannungen, have supposed to achieve a post-historical equilibrium in this grand overarching receptacle. Alles überspannenden Behälter. The Eastern Observer is opposed to such pretension and intervenes, drawing upon Christian anthropological motifs to claim that desire is insatiable. Quote, shower him with all earthly blessings. Drown him in happiness completely over his head, so that only bubbles pop up on the surface of happiness as on water. Give him such economic satisfaction that he no longer has anything left to do at all, except sleep, eat gingerbread, and worry about the non-cessation of world history, P.S. i.e. to have sex. And it is here, just here, that he, this man, out of sheer ingratitude, out of sheer lampoonery, will do something nasty. He will even risk his gingerbread. End quote. This challenge to the politics of happiness reveals two clearly distinct modes of post-historicity. In the first mode, human beings participate in systems of satisfaction, but from time to time escape the Crystal Palace to preserve their honour as human beings, that is, as those who are free to break with given conditions. In the most extreme case, on a whim, they opt for madness and self-destruction. In the second mode, human beings indeed remain excluded from the benefits of existing in the sphere of comfort, but find their own satisfaction in despising the contentment of the palace dwellers. Even the idle despiser lives in a post-historical situation, though with a twist, namely that such post-historicity contains elements of pre- and extra-historical existence, since it never participated in the struggles for historical satisfaction. And it is not subsequently inclined to struggle either. The first mode results in the comfortable post-histoire of a freedom reduced to absurd whims, half amusement park culture and half bloodbath, while the second mode results in the uncomfortable post-histoire of ressentiment, which remains condemned to self-satisfaction and otherwise to lethargy, due to its supposedly, or perhaps genuinely, greater depths, while suffering and doubt are eliminated in the system of comfort, or are at least continually reduced. Quote, what good is a crystal palace in which one can have doubts? End quote. Only partisans of ressentiment have the option of intentional suffering. Quote, and yet I'm certain that man will never renounce real suffering, that is, destruction and chaos. Suffering. Why, this is the sole cause of consciousness. End quote. The observing despiser of the Crystal Palace does not have an alternative project, as is to be expected, yet he remains parasitical on the faded historicity of others and shares in their end insofar as his contempt depends on it. Either human beings in the Crystal Palace are deluding themselves, and history is not really at an end, even for them, or it is in fact concluded, but then it's being at an end, and the satisfaction provided by the Crystal Palace would not amount to much, because the human resolution to suffer and to impose suffering has not been extinguished, even under post-historical conditions, as the underground man tries to demonstrate. With his will to suffer, he fends off the unreasonable demand that he should admire the accomplishments of the party that has triumphed in history. In his masochistic authenticity, the first opponent of globalization deflects the progressive's claim to superiority, though he seems to be susceptible to envy. He objects to a world of happiness with the thesis that another world is possible, a world in which there is still enough suffering to give the cold shoulder to history and its tranquilization by universal satisfaction. Before we explain how Heidegger pursued a similar line of thought 56 years later, although with a shift in emphasis and a more profound grasp of the metaphysics of history, we should recall a second Russian thinker whose work is inextricably associated with the motif of the end of history. As early as the beginning of the 1930s, only a short while after Heidegger's foray into the mood of post-historical boredom, Alexandre Kirchev had concluded from his studies of Hegel that human history was, in fact, over. Along with Dostoevsky, Kirchev shared the anthropological view that human existence represents a series of struggles that arise from the striving for satisfaction. Yet while the novelist interpreted satisfaction, in light of his religious doctrine of freedom, as a narcissistic enjoyment of rebellion that is always on the move and never leads anywhere, Kirchev interprets satisfaction to be an attainable goal of the struggle for recognition by the other. The concept of recognition thus becomes the political, psychodynamic, and spiritual key to world history, because the striving for recognition, if unsatisfied, is the main reason for the non-cessation of historical struggles. In contrast, if the striving is satisfied, it is reason enough for the cessation of hostilities and thus the conclusion of history. The fulfillment or non-fulfillment of the human demand to be recognized as free subject and sovereign source of negativity determines the difference between the happy and the unhappy consciousness. Historical movement resumes in conflicts in which the unhappy consciousness is utterly eliminated and turned into the happy consciousness. Kirchev views two fictional warring factions as world historical agents in this drama. The figures of Lord and Bondsman, whom we are familiar with from Hegel's Phenomenology of Spirit. A completely anthropologized history begins with the initial stages of their contention, starting with an imaginary primordial duel in which two freedoms grapple with each other as representatives of a surreal pride. The human realm was divided into victor and vanquished, with the former taking on the role of lord, while the latter ends up in the bases of the lord's freedom. While the latter ends up in the position of bondsman, who in future must see to the material bases of the lord's freedom. Here begins the era of labour, with its heteronomy and its struggles against this heteronomy. At the same time, this is also when the unhappy consciousness performs both sides. The lord's desire for recognition remains unsatisfied, because the bondsman, with his servile attitude towards the lord, cannot possibly provide equal recognition. Likewise, the bondsman is condemned to non-satisfaction, or a substitute gratification in religion due to the grim realities of his condition. In describing this struggle, everything hinges on the final position. It is thus characteristic that the bondsman, or the third estate, to put it in historical terms, trained and empowered by the labour he has performed for so long, finally obtains the means to successfully rebel against the lord. These means are systematically codified in the civil constitutional state, and as soon as this state were to reach its universal form, history would arrive at its imminent end as a sequence of struggles for recognition. An era of satisfied consciousness would have dawned. The phrase tutti contenti from the end of Mozart's and De Ponte's La Nozze di Figaro after Beaumarchais is the first word of post-history. From this point on, human beings must exercise their freedom by laboriously negating the given. That is, they must modify nature through their own labour in revolting against the Lord as an exploiter of servile labour. Human beings are constituted as the fortunately unemployed, that is, as proprietors of a power of negation who no longer finds any objects with which to seriously engage, thus becoming the post-historical homo ludens. The substantive content of post-history is either contemplative or cheerfully animalistic. With the exception of work that is no longer servile, in other words, aided by machines, we are left with art, sexuality and nonsense to fill the long afternoons of post-history. Kirchev's model, however, has history come to a standstill in the awareness of achieved satisfaction. Yet the philosopher pays a high price for his blithe thesis. splitting the meaning of the phrase, quote-unquote, end of history, into theoretical and empirical versions necessarily leads to ambiguity. If history is to end in theory, whether with the end of Hegel's phenomenology, while the thunder of cannons from the Battle of Jena booms in the background, or whether following the Russian Revolution and its violent consolidation by Stalin, we cannot but be embarrassed that the universal and homogeneous socialist constitutional state has been taking its sweet time arriving on the world historical stage. History would accordingly come to an end, to be sure, but not reach the goal. Thus Kojiv can get no further than a semi-post-history, in which much remains to be done empirically, although everything has been done in principle. This situation is reflected in the irony of the philosopher's happy consciousness as he comments on the disturbing fallout from the world's remaining misfortunes. A philosophical irony that is neither Socratic nor romantic, but rather post-historical, leads Kojiv to rely on the concept of the sage in order to re-legitimate provocatively the ancient fatalistic division of the human collective into the wise and the ignorant. Only in a truly universal state would the sage's irony be transformed into humour. If end and goal were to coincide, avant-garde sarcasm, which displays elements of impatience with those lagging behind, could be resolved into contemplation and benevolent retrospection.